It's a new day, and I guess some of you are new. You weren't here yesterday. This is a continuation of our sessions on liberation theology. And I'm Al Pitcher from the University of Chicago. I teach in the Divinity School. And I like to paint. Started about 3 years ago here. I'm very much interested in black liberation, and I'm really more interested now in our liberation from what I consider to be a very destructive, a very ambiguous, put it that way, a very ambiguous lifestyle in the United States. So one of the ways in which my interests have developed is concern for liberation theology. Liberation theology really comes out of South America. It has been picked up by James Cone, and so we now have black liberation theology, and we're beginning to get women's liberation theology. The forces that are leading to a kind of a new thinking of the ground of our Christian faith come out of South America, blacks, and women. And I want to run through the principles, some of which we discussed yesterday, of liberation theology. And the first principle is the union of what you might call a historical with an eschatological understanding of the Christian faith. The emphasis is on the historical, since it's assumed that the major thrust of the Christian faith has been eschatological. I can best talk about what's involved by using an analysis of a colleague of mine called the Two Covenants, in which the Christian faith, as it's expressed itself in the biblical faith, has two covenants. The first covenant, or one covenant, it's not first or second, one covenant is a covenant in which God is conceived of as the creator of the world, as a force which operates in and through the world, and a force which is the dominant force. And I guess you could say Gideon is an example in which Gideon throws away troops after troop, people after people, and finally depends upon God. He has 300 men left, as you know. So that it's the activity of God that makes the difference. And really, if you can plug into the activity of God, then everything takes care of itself. That is, it's a kind of a, what people say, is a vertical understanding of the Christian faith. It's over against the horizontal. And this covenant is, it's very prevalent in the Old Testament, and it really becomes dominant in the New Testament and in many aspects of the Christian faith. But the other covenant is a covenant in which God is acting in history, and the Exodus is the primary concern. Not the creation of the world, but God acting in the Exodus to help a people with Moses, his leadership, to free themselves. And so God, as you go through Samuel 24, is a kind of paradigmatic place for it. The reference is always to God is doing this through his people, and his people are covenanted with God to do this in response. And if they don't respond in terms of the covenant, then they are destroyed. It's not something going on above history. It's going on every day in the kind of ebb and flow of history. Now, the liberation theology wants to focus on the historical only because liberation theology thinks that the focus has been on the eschatological. They want to unite the two so that what it means is there is no liberation from sin and communion with God that isn't at the same time involved in a liberation from historical forces and the creation of historical forces, brotherhood, institutions that take into account men's needs, new society, so that you really get a kind of return to the social gospel emphasis that was prevalent in this country in the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. The second principle is a principle of conflict. Sin is conflict. History is seen in terms of a struggle between opposing forces, and it isn't God and the devil. One of the covenants would have it God and the devil are struggling, and there's a sense in which God has overcome the devil, but the struggle goes on. This is a struggle between forces in history, and liberation theology thinks it can identify the forces, the oppressed and the oppressors, and it tends to be a class analysis. That's characteristic of South America. It can't be a class analysis, I think, here, although some people would try to make it, but it becomes a black and white analysis here, or a female-male analysis here in terms of oppressors and oppressed. But the tendency is to see it in terms of a dialectic where you have opposing forces. And focus of liberation theology, the identification of liberation theology, will be with the oppressed. And so James Cone, who's the most well-known advocate of black liberation theology in his book Liberation, A Black Theology of Liberation, will say, if you don't identify with the blacks, you can't be a Christian. Christ identified with the oppressed. He didn't worry about the people with power and prestige and so forth. His whole life was given to the oppressed. And if you can make a neat division between oppressors and oppressed, which is a problem, but the South Americans think that there is a division. They follow a kind of Marxist analysis in which the primary analysis is in terms of economic and political power as over against the powerlessness. So they identify with the powerless. The conflict is radical. It's not a matter of reforming things. It's a matter of changing things. They think that the oppressed will liberate themselves. That is, the source for the new, for wholeness, the source for renewal, is in the oppressed. It's not in the oppressors. And so you got in the black movement a rejection of the whites. As they said, go back and take care of yourself. You can't help us. And some people really went so far as to say that the only real source for a newness in our culture is the black lower class that haven't absorbed all the values and all the mental attitudes of the white ruling class. Now, we developed that yesterday. A fourth principle has to do with the church. And the liberation theology, and the liberation theology I'm speaking of is represented in a kind of spokesman that everybody recognizes, Gustavo Gutierrez, in his book, A Theology of Liberation. And it's really worth getting and reading and thinking about and mulling over, because this is what's going to happen, that represents the direction of creative theology from South America, and it's going to permeate American churches, particularly the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church, of course, is the largest church, but the influence of that theology on the Catholic Church will more and more be evidenced in this country, and it, in turn, I think, will bring about a change in the Protestant church. It might actually, in the long run, bring about a change in the whole relationship of Protestants and Catholics. We may really have a new Reformation. Liberation theology may be really the beginning of a new Reformation in Christendom. The old Reformation, in a sense, was a mistake, because you can't get along without the foundation. I mean, to use Catholic with a small c, without the substance that the Catholic Church represented, not necessarily its belief in the church as the only ground for salvation and justification by religious works and all the things Luther was against. At any rate, the church will be involved in history. It will not be sitting on the sidelines. The The church in South America, of course, is split because according to liberation theology, the church in South America, like the church everywhere, identifies itself with the ruling power structure. And whether it wants to or not, by virtue of it not taking any real stand with regard to the life in common, it becomes a support for the church, for the life that is. So in terms of their analysis in South America, the church supports the junta in Chile. It either really deals with the world, or without any explicit reference to it, it becomes a support. And the church in turn is supported by the ruling power. So that there isn't any place for neutrality according to liberation theology. And liberation theology says the church must cast its lot with the oppressed. Our problem in this country is to locate the oppressed if we follow this line. It's not an easy thing to know in this country. In South America, it seems very clear to these liberation theology leaders that the vast majority of people in South America are the poor, the oppressed. And so the church really has to begin to identify itself with that. With all the problems of identification with any particular group or with any particular movement. But they say to evangelize is to politicize. In other words, if the gospel is really being preached, they would say in South America, it is going to create forces of liberation, political forces of liberation in that community. They say, for example, that the dominant forces are really identified with a whole dominant culture. And I frequently have said, in trying to deal with the Missouri Synod squabble, that in part the Missouri Synod squabble, to my mind, represents the identification of the leadership of the church with a whole way of life in America, which I'll get into later because I want to illustrate what I think liberation theology might begin to do in America. So that the squabble is not simply ecclesiological or theological. The squabble is political and economic. And from the point of view of liberation theology, you get a very close identification of theological leadership, church leadership, with political and economic forces, whether it wills it or not. And if it doesn't become explicit about it, it will support the status quo. And that's really what liberation theology in South America is saying, that the church has tended to support the status quo. The fifth principle is that one has to start with rejection of the existing situation. In other words, they assume that the existing situation is really destructive, inhuman, does not represent love, is contrary to brotherhood or sisterhood, and that it's necessary to make what they call a scientific analysis of the situation. In other words, they would say all faith, to be responsible, must have an interpretation of what is going on in the situation, must have some sort of scientific analysis, scientific in quotes, of what the situation is. In South America, the interpretation is on the basis of class struggle. I think it's very difficult in America to use a Marxist notion of class to describe our situation. But if you took their principle, it would say you cannot be responsible in this country as a religious leader unless you have an interpretation of what the situation is. And here I portray my bias, because I think it makes all the difference in the world where you begin to think about what is going on. So how you interpret the present situation. I say we are in the control of a demonic ethos in this country, which keeps us struggling to become and to to reach a standard of living and to have all the things which really destroy our possibility of being human. I don't say they destroy it completely. They make it difficult. Nothing is impossible with God, and nothing is impossible with the Christian freedom, but they make it very difficult. Now, many of my colleagues start at different places, and people with all the same education, all the same tools, all the same knowledge, just interpret the situation completely differently. We've had a running seminar for 4 years in which my colleague and I take one position, and our best student, the best student we ever created, who knows more than we do about everything we know about, takes a different position. I mean, I'm not trying to make this simple. I'm just trying to reflect the fact that it makes a great deal of difference, and we don't know why people take these different positions. It is impossible to tell. One of my colleagues said, "Well, I had all my problems because I felt rejected, and that's why I was rejecting American society, because somewhere back in my childhood I hadn't been loved enough, and therefore I took this somewhat pessimistic notion about the direction of American society." I don't know, but in South America at least, this liberation theology movement has followed a kind of Marxian analysis, which sees the struggle between the owners and the rulers and the people as a whole. And so it follows, if you take that analysis, that has to be overcome, and then the question is, how can it be overcome? And the liberation theology wouldn't agree on how it's to be overcome, but they agree on the analysis that the problem is one of the privileged class having for itself and not acting in such a way as to take into account the poor and the destitute, and that's the vast majority of people. Now, the sixth principle is a new spirituality, according to Gutierrez, that we really need a new understanding of spirituality. And that understanding of spirituality is really, in a way, the same as the principle I began with, namely that, he says, three things are really one part in your spirituality: the liberation from sin and the entrance into communion with God and with all men is integrally related to the economic, social, and political liberation, is integrally related to the creation of a new man in a new society of solidarity. He cites those three things. They seem to be, in some ways, not separate. But what he's trying to say is, I think, that there's no spirituality which isn't worldly. That spirit is a very concrete thing. Spirit is not something off. Spirit is the unity of body and mind and heart and soul. It's the unity. And the spirituality involves all of that. Some doctrines of man would insist that you just can't understand. And I always think of what we call psychosomatic disease, that the physical and psychological are part and parcel. And you can just take it one step further and say the physical, the biological, the psychological, the spiritual are all part and parcel. You don't deal with one really without dealing with the other. There's no simple way in which they influence each other, but the economic, political, the biological influences the whole spirit of man, and the spirit of man influences the whole man. There's a sense in which that is very basic for them. Now, there's seventh principle is the understanding of time. And Gutierrez says that primitive societies have emphasized the past and what has happened in the past, what he calls a kind of pre-critical mentality, and you relate to things and to events in the past, and your meanings come out of relating to those things which have happened as over against the creation of the future. So that the emphasis in liberation theology would be on the creation of the future. That's a problem I have with, I have a real problem with our effort simply to live in terms of the future, but that's the emphasis at least. Now, I want to return for a minute to the fundamental assumption that underlies all of this. And Gutierrez develops it on page 158 in this volume, and he refers to the texts, to the biblical texts on the basis of which he develops this. And I just want to attend to this for a minute, because I think this is very crucial. Basic understanding comes out of the prologue of John, but it's throughout the Pauline corpus too, in which in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word. And what is the Word? What is the Word? He was in the beginning with God. The Word was He, Jesus Christ. All things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. He was in the world, and the world was made through Him, yet the world knew Him not. He came to His own home, and His own people received Him not. But to all who received Him, who believed in His name, He gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And then if you go to Colossians 1:15-20, for in Him, in Jesus Christ, all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or authorities, all things were created through Him and for Him. 1 Corinthians 8:6. Yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. Hebrews 1:2. But in these last days He has spoken to us by a Son, whom He appointed the heir of all things, through whom also He created the world. Now, then Ephesians 1:1-22. The meaning of this for me is that, and I really believed this before I read Gutierrez, that Christ is the second person of the Trinity. The Word, Father, Son, Spirit. Christ is the second person of the Trinity. You relate to Christ when you relate to that reality in whom, through whom, for whom, by whom, everything was created that was created. Christ is not an abstraction then, according to this theological position. Christ is a part of the world. He's a part of our very beings. He's a part of everything that goes on. And insofar as we respond in all of our relationships, in everything we do, nature included, it does not exempt nature from this. We respond to Christ. Christ is in and through. It's a mysterious notion. It's not easy to comprehend. But the symbolic meaning of it is very clear to me. You relate to Christ every time you do anything, or you don't relate to Him. You deny Him or you accept Him. You commune with Him when you eat, when you play, when you make love, when you do anything in nature, when you enjoy the birds or whatever it is. This is not, Christ is not an abstraction from the whole of reality. That's the foundation for liberation theology. I emphasize it because it's a very, very different notion, I think, of Christ from that which some of us have come to accept, or we haven't thought about it in that way. We haven't really thought too much about the meaning of the word or of Christ as being the second person in the Trinity. And these texts, it's very easy just kind of to ignore the meaning of a lot of texts. At any rate, that's the foundation. Now, I really want to, I've got so much to do today, I really want to bring this down to earth today. And I know there's a lot to discuss in what I've said already, but I really want to challenge you by illustrating what I think this would mean if you would take this position about America. I don't want to suggest that anything I say now is true or very perceptive or valid. This is my response in the light of this work group that we've had all year in preparation for the conference with the South American liberation theologians and social scientists this summer. This is my response to our work group. This is what this is the way I summarize what would be said, I think, to be in the spirit of liberation theology. Now, I entitle it Liberation Theology. It presumes all the principles I've talked about. Then it tries to address American reality and deal with an interpretation of American reality and what liberation in the spirit of liberation theology would look like in American theology. So I just want to kind of illustrate how you begin to work if you come out of this kind of a framework. Very systematic theological framework is presupposed. The kind of framework I've laid out. We began by a study of Chile and the multinational corporations, since the conference attempts to deal with South American reality and American reality. It really is American reality, but what we thought would be interesting, if we could come out of the same kind of experience that the South Americans have had. So we tried to address the reality that the South Americans were talking about, namely our relationship and our domination. They assume that the greatest oppressor of South America is North America. That's really the enemy. And the enemy the enemy is a combination of North America and the people in South America who profit from, relate to, support the North American use of South America economically and politically. So that this is a fairly, I think, realistic attempt to deal with America the way the South Americans might look at us. But it's my response. I just sat down and wrote it one day. It took me a whole day. I just sat down and wrote it. It's not a refined document. Examination of the actions relating to Chile taken by forces representing aspects of the United States social and political life indicates that there are powerful and pervasive forces in the United States that function without the knowledge and permission of citizens. I have referenced the Committee of 40, the CIA, the way our military were training the South Americans, all kinds of things. I call that the industrial military governmental complex. It functions without our knowledge and it functions without our control. Citizens are not informed about issues and decisions. We knew nothing about what we were doing in South America. We didn't know what the Committee of 40 had decided. We didn't know what the CIA, didn't know the millions of dollars that were poured into Chile to do something on our behalf. In fact, we are misinformed in order that we will not participate in the formation of policy or in a critique of the operations. I have here reference to Vietnam, the best and the brightest, or what is it, hearts and minds, the extent to which Johnson created the Gulf of Tonkin incident in order that he could get the military intervention, in order that he could appear to be a hawk and not a dove, in order that he could win an election. And we were not aware of what was going on. The government, the military, and the corporations collaborated in an effort to discredit, I'm talking now about Chile, undermine, and eventually to destroy all forces working toward a democratic socialist state in Chile. I don't think there's any question about the collaboration and the intent. Liberation involves, in the first place then, in America, the unmasking of these structures of autonomous power, that is, these structures that are functioning without our knowledge or without our capacity to direct or control. Citizens must come to understand what is taking place. A study of what happened in Chile or a study of what happened in Vietnam, as portrayed by David Halberstam in The Best and the Brightest, would prepare the way for realizing how much we live in a political illusion. I borrow that from Jacques Ellul, a political illusion. He says the same thing about France. There's no real people control. And how much some change in our polity, in the structure of our relation to our government and to these forces is necessary. I think we could find the same thing with regard to the Atomic Energy Commission. The decision has been made and the nuclear plants have been built, they've been supported by the government, the research has been done on them, and we have not participated at all. Two steps are necessary. The first involves the subordination of the economic and the social to the political. That is to say, I really, at this point today, believe, maybe not tomorrow, Paul Hain gets at me, I have questions, but at any rate, that we cannot operate on a system which believes that you can serve your own self-interest and serve the common good. There's some truth to it. But how do you begin to get a consideration of what the good for the world is and the good for this nation is into the decisions of corporations and of military and of government? The principle I'm asserting is that the economic has to be more and more subordinated to the political. Now, there are many ways to do this without having all economic decisions in the hands of bureaucrats. That's a false attack. There are many ways to get control of what is going on or some supervision of what is going on without putting all the decisions in the hands of bureaucrats. Many things can be left to the market. Political intervention, carefully considered and limited, is absolutely essential for the future health, stability, and survival of a viable society. And this afternoon I'll be talking about energy, as you know, we started yesterday, and the kinds of decisions that are involved regarding energy that simply cannot be left to chance, to the kind of interaction of interested groups without some real public concern and public discussion. Intervention, however, involves a second step, namely the formulation of a vision for the society, a public philosophy, which gives some basis for the intervention other than the interests of the powerful forces that have been functioning privately and autonomously. In other words, it's kind of un-American, but I believe you've got to have some vision of what is good. This is what liberation theology is saying. You've got to have some analysis of where the society ought to go. You can't just leave it to the kind of free forces to operate. This requires that the power of the autonomous forces, the economic forces, be curtailed, and that a public be developed from what seems now to be a chaotic, fragmented, powerless, uninformed citizenry. I think we are really chaotic, fragmented, powerless, and uninformed as a public. And our discussion of energy yesterday just revealed that we haven't even got the ghost of a notion, many of us, of what the issues are in energy, what the great decisions are being made that affect our whole future. Politics must take responsibility for what happens and therefore be in a position to influence events and politics must represent an imaginative, realistic, responsible, and recognizable vision and program. This is contrary to America. Boston in The Genius of American Democracy says, our genius is that we don't have any plans. We don't have any visions. It's like the Jewish Holy of Holies. It's empty. We just say no to everybody, but we don't say yes to any common vision. Secondly, liberation involves dialogue with representatives of a variety of groups and forces from the nations of the world. I'm completely convinced that we cannot make decisions simply on the basis of national interest any longer. The interrelation of the world is just too great. If you sell to Brazil, as Germany just did, nuclear power equipment, and you give them the enriching process by virtue of which they can enrich uranium, and therefore they have the process by virtue of which you can get the stuff for the bomb, you've given them the bomb. France sold it to Israel. Israel has the bomb, I'm convinced. Brazil will have the bomb. They're not a part of the non-proliferation agreement on the making of bombs. There's no way for us to deal, you know, just nationally with what's going on. The whole world is so interrelated, and the Arab use of oil as a kind of hammer over our heads indicates this. So we've got to, you know, more and more have conversation with the rest of the world and what's happening, and conversation like we're having this summer with South Americans, how they view what we're doing to them. So if the first liberation is liberation from forces of our own that are out of our control, the second liberation is liberation from forces of our own that do not seem to take into account the forces and the interests of other nations. Now, we all know the difficulties that are involved with the League of Nations and with the United Nations. Christians, it seems to me, the church of the world simply has to be in conversation with all parts of the church about how every part of the church sees what is happening through the people who are in the other part of the church. And that really means a conversation with the people who feel that we are oppressing them. The least we could hope for is a global perspective that relates national self-constitution to humanity, that relates our freedom to do what we want. That's what I mean by self-constitution to humanity, to all men, to the global family. This is not simple, because that's, in a way, is what we were doing in Vietnam. We thought we were taking into account their interests. So it's not a simple matter. It so much depends upon with whom you identify in other countries. Seems to me we identified with the wrong forces, but that's a very, very human judgment. Thirdly, liberation involves a consideration of what is at stake in the kind of world we are building, in the kind of life we are creating. Some would say in the kind of grave we are digging. Liberation is liberation from the domination, I say, of economic growth as the primary principle for decision-making, from the production of things, from the elaboration of complex services such as hospitals. Here I follow Ivan Illich, a new book out, Medical Nemesis, in which he deals with the technology of hospitals and finds it very demonic. In other words, it's a nemesis. From the forces creating obsolescence physically and psychologically, and from the pressure for consumption. Liberation is liberation from the domination of the new. I couldn't help thinking about that in Matins. Every time we say new every morning, the question is, what does it mean? You know, a new chance, free from the past, you might say. But if it means the creation of the new, from the inescapable press toward new things, new knowledge, new ways of doing things, I have real questions. Simply for the sake of the new, sometimes, I think. Liberation involves the space and time, physically, economically, psychologically, and spiritually, to resist these directions, to experiment, to reflect, to weigh alternatives. Got to get some distance from those things which shape our lives, which we have considered to be absolutely essential for and to be good and to be a pattern for the rest of the world, which it's obvious it can't be, I think, now. Time to revisit the past, to catch up with ourselves, to savor something. Liberation involves liberation for participation in mythic, cultic, and ritualistic realities that involve more communal, I use all these big words, ascriptive. Ascriptive means where you are given your status because you are, not because of what you've achieved. It's what we really believe as Lutherans. You can't get any status by achieving, by doing anything, by working, by loving, you can't even get status by loving as a Lutheran. You get your status from God. It's ascribed to you because you're a human being. Our whole status system in this country is achievement-oriented. You are given a status because you've achieved something. You've achieved a big church, or you got a lot of converted souls. It doesn't matter what your occupation is. Fourthly, liberation involves a consideration of the social philosophy or the ideology that underlies what is done. In the United States, the fundamental image of good action is the interaction of self-interest. What we want to do is to provide maximum opportunity for people to do more or less as they please, as long as it doesn't get in anybody else's way. That's the social model. It's interacting self-initiations which regulate each other. It came out of Federalist 10, Madison and Federalist 10, Federalist Papers. Very basic part of our whole social philosophy. Now, I think that we've lived on it for a long time, and I think it has a great deal of validity, but I cannot see it as the constituting principle of our common life. I see it as a regulative principle. So we have to be liberated from that model. And it's liberation for the exploration of alternatives. And I don't know exactly what that means. What we've seen happen in Russia certainly isn't what we want. But it certainly means some experimentation with some other models. And real questioning about a market kind of system in which people are encouraged to follow their self-interest is so anti-Christian. See, you've either got to take a view of the world which says the world is always going to be full of sin and the darkness and there's not much hope for it, and anyway it isn't where Christ is anyway because our relation to Christ is in this kind of vertical. That's why it goes back very much directly to the first principle. If you take that vertical kind of relationship, then you can interpret the world, the created world, as a world of sin and darkness, a kind of cradle for a salvation process which is external to it, not involved in it at all. But if salvation is involved in the world, if Christ is in and through the whole world, then you reject him or accept him on the basis of how you treat the world. And then if we treat the world as a place where you assume people can follow whatever their self-interests are, whatever the interests are, and somehow there's an automatic harmony which brings out the good. It seems to me it's certainly anti the liberation view of the world. Liberation is fifthly liberation from economic, social, and cultural exploitation. It's liberation from a system of production that so determines the hours, the weeks, the conditions of earning enough money to purchase the necessities of life that one cannot easily do anything but fit in. Some people are beginning, share a job. Two people take on a teaching job. Take on a job for 25 or 30 hours a week so you can do your thing. We got to really get our whole system in tune with a way of living which frees us from what I call the tyranny of necessity. We get involved with the whole realm of necessity, and you get involved with a job. I work 7 hours a week, 7 days, I mean about 11 hours a week, 7 days a week, in order that I could make my role. I mean that I could get my job as a professor. I get my tenure, then I relaxed. But I had to work like that to get it. And most people in that situation, for all kinds of reasons, continue. It's ambiguous. But that's the kind of pressure you're under. My colleague two years ago worked 13 hours a day all summer while I was up here kind of enjoying myself. I only worked 4 hours in the morning, and then I was free to talk to you and other things. I did my own thing 4 hours in the morning. But he was doing that so he could get a tenure job in my school. Then he didn't get it. But he was forced into that mold. Why was he forced into that mold? I don't know why we're forced into these molds. But we are. And somehow we've got to get some freedom from that. You may want to work 13 hours a day, 7 days a week at something. But it shouldn't be, because you've got to do it in order to earn a living. You ought to be able to earn a living and then be free to do that if you want to. But if somehow to be free to do your thing forces you into that kind of a mold, because forces, I say, not because you choose it freely, it's the thing you want to do because you come to that in your freedom, then there's something wrong. So we've got to get liberated, a very simple phrase would be, from the tyranny of necessity. And the liberation for is to provide some assurance for these basic needs, food, shelter, health, education, welfare. Of course, I think it requires a change also in our view of education. We've got to be freed somehow from the tremendous costs of education. And of course, part of that is getting freed from the sense that our kids have got to make it, and the only way they're going to make it is to go to certain schools, and then it's going to cost us $5,000 a year to anywhere from 3 to 5 at those schools. So all kinds of things are involved. I'm trying to indicate what liberation might mean in this country. Sixthly, liberation is liberation from scientific, technological rationality, a rationality that focuses upon the measurable and the controllable. This rationality emphasizes knowledge about nature, about society, about culture, and about religion. That's what my school is doing. It's emphasizing knowledge about religion, and it's training people to go into colleges who will be able to teach people about religion. No. That's to say, knowledge about is over involvement in, or commitment to, or truth of. It's a whole scientific attitude. I use religion here because I think it's the greatest paradox that in a school of religion, your concern is with knowledge about religion. It's over against being religious, you know, about being faithful. And so you're training people who have a lot of knowledge about. And then they're going out into colleges, and it's not completely demonic, because there are many people who survive this system and who, for one reason or another, maintain their faith and their concern for the culture. My colleague just left the school because he didn't see any possibility of witnessing to the kind of world that I'm trying to address in this paper. He and I were in this work group together, and this represents, I think, something that he would subscribe to. He saw no possibility of trying to do this in the divinity school. He didn't see any support for it. Any real concern for addressing the world, you know, the world. And if Christ is out there in the world, our world, you've got to address our world, and it's fine to deal with what Aquinas said in fine detail, but the question is, what does Aquinas say to our world and to your situation today? Not what he said, quay what he said, but how in the world does that make any difference to you? I use that as an illustration because I'm not just talking abstractly. I'm talking really out of my very existential concern with education. That's what I know about, and that's where I know where these problems exist, and that's where I'm caught in a somewhat demonic structure of concern. Seventhly, I guess I finished that one enough. It's liberation is liberation from a way of thinking in which reason is instrumental, in which reason is technical. Reason becomes a way of penetrating to the truth, to the meaning of things, to the value of things. Reason reveals ourselves to ourselves, our deepest nature. It's a process in which we are transformed in our being by discovering the truth, by discovering the real through reason. Not simply a matter of how you get from here to there. I may do a disservice to much of what's going on in universities and to much of reason. Seventhly, liberation is a liberation from an educational system that is conceived of largely as a way to instrumental knowledge and to placement in the economic system. Oh, the gyrations our colleges are now going through because they got to justify what they're doing in terms of the job market. And you've got all kinds of things being introduced into liberal arts colleges in order to prepare people for what's out there in terms of job market. How can a liberal arts college prepare anybody to take a job? And the University of Chicago's college going the same way. It used to have a great college in which you came there to think about the fundamental issues in life. Fundamental questions of human existence. And now slowly the departments are taking over because they want to get their, you know, they want to get their students early and begin to prepare them to deal specifically with all kinds of special things. And so you really don't have the time and energy. And it's understandable, see. I don't, you got to get a job, you got to earn a living. But how are we going to make education be what it should be? Introduction into the community of faith. That's what education is. Education is introduction into a community of faith. Now, if you take faith in the broad sense I've used faith, it's introduction into a way of life, which is responding in faith to the whole range of reality that is our reality. That's what education is. It's giving you a way of looking at it so that you can live meaningfully in it. Respond to it with meaning. It's not preparing you for a job. I mean, fundamentally it shouldn't be. Now there are all kinds of technical education that should go on, but I'm thinking of education in the broad sense. Why do we have here at Holden what they call lifestyle program? Take people after high school or those who've dropped out of college for some reason or other and try to get them ready to go back to college or to go to college. So they have the questions, so they have a perspective, so they have some meanings, so they understand what's going on there is over against what they'd like to have going on. Most students who go to college don't even know what the alternatives would be. That's what a real education in which meaning is really sought. And I probably do a disservice to a great many professors and a great many colleges when I speak this way. So I have to say again, that's just growing out of my experience in my school, which majors in meaning. I mean, its concern is with meaning, of course, because its concern is with religion. Well, I think I'm about through with this. I say education is introduction into a community of meaning. The problem, of course, is that we do not have a liberated society. We do not have an explicit community of meaning that is related to the world. Our churches are not communities of meaning which are related to the whole range of aspects of our common life. So if the education is supposed to introduce you into that community, it's a real problem. Holden can't be that, although it's that more than any other place I know, because it's not out in the community. Paul Ain is thinking next year. He has decided to go to Seattle next year and set up a community which would try to be a community living in the world which would try to do this. See, the great issue in liberated education is to provide alternative modes of being or of experience, so that students and teachers may experience the meaning of liberation from and liberation for. So the task is to find and nourish a community of meaning that is related to what education is involved in. See, how do you introduce a person in that community if you don't have that community? So I say the only thing you can do is help people live on the edge of institutions today. So your education is an education. How do you live in an institution which you can't give yourself to maybe more than 30%. Really, if you think about it, how can you give yourself to Chrysler Motor Corporation today to produce those cars that eat up all that gasoline that, you know, when there's such a short supply? How can you do that? And so you have, how can I live at the university under the situation? So we need communities which help us live on the edge of these institutions. Finally, liberation is liberation from a style of life that binds one physically, intellectually, and spiritually to the operations of I think, a very questionable institutional life, in terms of our economic life, our military demands, our governmental operation. How do we do that? Well, that's the issue, and I think liberation is liberation for that. I want to give you just a little illustration of how, if you came out of this view of liberation theology, you begin to look at our common existence and our own life. And I think it's just one illustration. Now it's really time for us to break. The bell is going to ring, but somebody may want to really hop in and, you know, I don't want this to be simply my point of view that you get without having somebody else say, no, 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 that's crazy. So you have a chance to say no or affirm it.
When you spoke of the, in the early parts about the spirit has to be worldly, you're using worldly in the sense of being a part of, well, not in the sense that preachers use it, worldly being demonic or...
No, it's a very positive notion. Christ is a part of the creation. It's our whole world of nature and of human relations, of human institutions.
You sound like you're describing a utopian community, and we've had a number of such experiments, of course, across the years. In what way do you see a difference in this description this morning, the same principles, problem of the hope of a utopia?
I don't see it as different. I don't see any problem with utopias. They come and go, and they have a kind of a leavening effect, and all kinds of changes occur because of that kind of thought. I think utopian thought is absolutely essential. If you don't believe somehow that, you know, God wills that exactly what you think should happen, but you realize it's simply it's a tool. And it's very fragile, very human, very subjective. So you're always living it with it very, very relatively, but you're living with it. No, it's just like any other idea you have for your existence. You've got to take it as a plan, and then you hold it very loosely. Say God may change, but it is a projection of where you're going and what it means to be faithful.